This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, Whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more five-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain.
As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. So before we get started here, I don't know if you've noticed, but if you go over to rocketship.fm, we have completely redesigned the site and introduced a really easy way to keep up with these series, where we're including the interviews and the series episodes all on one really elegant page, so you can quickly browse and listen to the whole series at once, if that's easier than on your podcast device. So today we have an interview with John Shumate, who is the CEO of Venture First. Now, Venture First is a financial services group that's focused on helping entrepreneurs. So they work with entrepreneurs, they work with venture capital firms. Oftentimes they're helping entrepreneurs raise their seed round. They're a little bit farther along. They may be helping them negotiate a acquisition or a merger. So we get a really interesting perspective on looking at the VC economy from the kind of the outside in. So stay tuned. You're really going to enjoy this one. Welcome to Rocketship.fm, a podcast where we explore startups from funding to growth, from culture to sales, and everything in between. I'm Michael Sacco.
And I'm Joelle Goldman.
All right. Well, first, thank you so much for coming on, especially with short notice. I'm glad we could grab you here.
Yeah, no problem.
Tell me a bit about Venture First and what you guys are doing there.
Venture First is does a lot of the same investment banking activities that the big boys do, but we're a little bit less traditional. So we're typically trying to deliver those activities for early stage technology and healthcare companies.
Okay.
And also working with investors in early stage companies. So whether it's a seed or angel investor or larger venture capital groups. And then, you know, services, you know, we do a lot. We end up getting to know a lot of the venture capital groups because we do a lot of their valuation work. Whether that's pricing options or valuing their portfolios or pricing around or whatever it is. And then for the entrepreneurs, we end up, helping them get ready to raise capital for larger early stage companies do an acquisition or maybe eventually be sold.
What are some of the trends that you're seeing in the industry around funding sizes and, you know, different rounds that companies are able to raise?
Well, I think for the past few years, a lot of funds have poured into the venture space. Probably temporarily, with a little bit less accountability for the general partners in those funds, which I think is actually going to dry up a little bit. So I think we've seen the sizes of rounds, that is dollars invested, grow, and I think we've seen valuations for most early stage companies tick up a little bit. I think we've seen valuations for obviously for the unicorns, the household names that you hear. I think most people would agree completely inflated, and that is probably a bubble.
Okay.
But I don't believe that is necessarily the case for other early stage companies.
Do you think that bubble will affect, those early stage companies today? Or not today, but that are looking to raise soon. I'm not saying like a catastrophic event, but you know, if more and more people are kind of convinced that it's overvalued at that unicorn stage.
I don't think for most early stage companies that the bubble is going to pop.
Okay.
I think that there could be a contagion from some of that hysteria from the unicorns where a little bit of the air is let out of the bubble. And so, valuations might not be as aggressive, but look, at the end of the day, if you're developing the next cancer therapeutic or the next great piece of software and there's a use and there's a market, there's a value for that.
Right. Yeah. That's great to hear. There's so much scare talk, out there today, but, so we're here to kind of talk about, negotiating closing deals. And I'd love to hear, where do you start with young entrepreneurs, teaching them about that negotiation process?
Well, I've always said I really believe on the negotiation side and in the deal side in general, that so much of it starts with personality and with relationship with the investor or with the potential investor. And I will tell you, when two parties have common ground and get along and believe that one another are going to be good partners in the deal, it's easier to get a deal done and the terms are less onerous, that people are trying to find fewer protections when they trust someone. So I think it always starts with people.
And are there things that, you know, people do that, you know, lose trust or, you know, potentially could create I guess the wrong impression?
I think too often even some very sophisticated entrepreneurs don't listen. And investors want to believe that, you know, whatever path they go down with you, and there's always going to be an obstacle. If they go down a path with you and there's a problem, are you going to play well in the sandbox? Are you going to at least listen to their advice and take some coaching? And I've seen very smart, very successful entrepreneurs who had past successes go out and try to do a round with terms that were probably reasonable, with a valuation that was probably reasonable, and they were abrasive. And it was their way or the highway. And they didn't seem like they were going to take any coaching at all. And that doesn't play well.
Yeah, yeah. What are some of the things that people get caught up on when they're negotiating the deal that maybe they shouldn't be? But
well, I think the big thing is obviously entrepreneurs get caught up on dilution, and they say, "Wow, you know, I'm giving up this big chunk of the company, and you know, by the time we do a few rounds, I'm, you know, at some point I'm not going to be the majority shareholder," and that's scary, and I understand that, but I've seen entrepreneurs, you know, squabble over a couple points of dilution here or there, and you know, they end up not raising enough cash or being so tight on the terms that they don't realize. For most entrepreneurs, if they get enough cash and they knock it out of the park, it's going to be a life-changing event. Mm-hmm. And the biggest reason that early-stage companies fail, good ones fail, is because they run out of cash. So I would say that's the big one on the entrepreneur side. On the investor side, you know, similarly, I've seen investors try to put terms out there that don't leave a lot of additional meat on the bone. And you know, you want to make sure you're in, you know, whether it's with options or with bonus or additional upside, or you know, topping the entrepreneur off on each round. You know, make sure they're excited to come in every day, because in reality, you know, you're betting on them.
Are there things that you know, an entrepreneur can ask for in these negotiations that, you know, maybe, you know, certain things might be off the table, but like you mentioned, you know, topping them off and different kinds of bonuses in the rounds that, you know, maybe they're not even aware of, that's an option right now?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that you can do, I mean, most investors will try to come in with a participating preferred structure. So, you know, just for a refresher, what that means is that upon a liquidity event, the investor gets their money back first, typically with a dividend, and then whatever's left over, they participate with again with management and whoever else is on the cap table. So there's a little bit of a double dip there.
Okay,
and this is. You know, a holdover from later stage private equity that they've started doing venture for a good while now. And now even angel investors try to do this. But something sometimes you can push back on is asking for a convertible preferred. So that's it's either or. If it's not a good scenario, and otherwise the investor wouldn't get their money back in a ratable split, then they have a floor. They get their money back plus the dividend. But if they would have done well or done better with just a simple ratable split of the pie, then that's where they convert and they participate just like everyone else. And so it feels like you're more in the sandbox with everyone else. And so I always encourage entrepreneurs to negotiate for that if they can. Mm-hmm. And some groups simply won't do it.
Interesting. Okay.
This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com.
And what is that? I mean, can you break that down a little bit more for me? Because I'm actually not that familiar with some of the terminology there, like how they're breaking off a dividend and, you know, how does that work? And if it's too complex, I totally understand.
Sure. But so why don't I just use an example?
Okay.
So I'm going to use a simple example. So let's say that a venture capital group invests $1 million for round numbers. And let's say that they have, a 10% accumulating annual dividend. And let's say they're asking for what's known as participating preferred. So if a company sold for, say, $10 million, they would get back, and let's say it's sold 2 years out, right? So they'd invest $1 million at a 10% dividend, they'd accrued $100,000 a year. So if it's sold 2 years out from that deal, they would first get back their $1.2 million, and then whatever's left over, let's say they owned, 20% of that, they would then again share in that 20% of the additional deal.
Okay.
But I'm saying on the convertible preferred, it's either or. So if they're proceeds just dividing the pie evenly among everybody. No, last in, first out, so to speak. If they just divided the pie evenly, and that share was more than $1.2 million, that's all they would get. That's the same amount that they would have gotten in addition to the $1.2 million in the participating preferred example.
Okay.
But if, let's say, the company only sold for $2 million.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't be enough to go around. They would just get their $1.2 million.
I see. So it incentivizes a better liquidity event, a larger liquidity event, and kind of puts the motivations in the right places.
I think that's right. It says, look, if we don't do well, we're going to protect your investor capital. We're going to try to get that back first.
Right.
But if we do well, we're all going to participate on the same terms.
Right. Very cool. I hadn't heard that before. That's really interesting. What are some tips for closing the deal with an investor when you have that term sheet and you're negotiating in the final stages?
Yeah. Oversubscribe your round.
Okay.
Get so many people looking at it that there becomes a hysteria, and that's easier said than done.
Yes.
but really the tip, is finding a good lead who really understands your space, knows how they're going to be able to drive value and help you grow things. And then everybody else follows. So that's kind of the most important thing. I've seen a lot of rounds where there's more investors who want to invest than there's capital that's needed, but no one wants to step and be that lead. So that's important. other tips. I think while you're in a round, if you can, continually, win on the operational side and give them updates and say, hey, we just closed this big deal, by the way, we're talking to this big customer, keep feeding them, strong potential information, and then play them off one another, even if you're just in talks with someone else, tell them that you're in advanced talks and, you really like them, but these guys don't want to, a lot of the venture community is sort of, they're sort of what, frenemies, so to speak. Right. Right. They'll co-invest in deals. They go to conferences together. They know these guys and they know one another, but they don't want that next awesome deal going to their competitor over there. So building that hysteria, however you can figure out doing it, and people know how to do this, even if this is your first rodeo in business. It's like the dating scene, right? Mm-hmm. when everybody wants to, date that one attractive girl, everybody's knocking on their door.
So. one of the hardest things for entrepreneurs to kind of wrap their head around is valuations. How do you look at valuing an early stage company?
Well, as Mark Cuban says, it's the value of a company, at least from an investment standpoint, is only as good as the cash that you're eventually going to get out of it. Mm-hmm. You value different early stage companies differently, depending upon industry. But at the end of the day, the commonality is that it's all based upon what you're going to make in the future. You're certainly not going to be at the earliest stage. Let's say you're pre-revenue. You're certainly not going to be valued on a revenue multiple yet, or an earnings or a EBITDA or earnings multiple yet. It's going to be a discounted cash flow, thinking about, what you're going to make in the future. And, if you model it out several years, and think about, if you're a pharmaceutical company, depending on what you're doing, maybe you're, 3 to 5 times revenue in the future. And, depending on, what technology you're running, maybe you're, 2 to 4 times, or maybe you're able to eventually sell to a strategic for way more than that. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, what an investor's calculating is what kind of return they're going to be able to get on their investment. So once you look forward to the point that they've been diluted, what percentage of the company do you think they're going to own out there, and what's the return on their investment? And if you are a seed investor, you're probably looking to get 6 or more times your money back. If you're an angel investor, you're probably looking to get 4 or 5 times your money back. And, with the mix of companies that they have, most venture capital groups are trying to at least beat that 35% mark. So you can kind of back into those numbers to try to figure out what works. Now, depending on your geography, there's probably some rules of thumb. If you're in the Midwest, an angel round, a lot of the investors might feel like, that's a $3 million pre-money valuation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that same company in Silicon Valley might get twice that valuation or more. So some of it does depend on your geography and who you've been able to network in with.
Okay. Interesting. What, is it okay? I mean, should everyone go to San Francisco, or is it okay to take that lower evaluation with the local investors in your market?
Yeah, I actually don't think everyone should go to San Francisco, and there's people that would disagree with me squarely about this, but there's some great, and I love San Francisco, by the way, but I'll also tell you, San Francisco is one of the most expensive cities to live in.
Yeah.
You can park in Nashville, Tennessee, for example, which has a great growing early stage scene right now. And if you're a music fan, you can go listen to music as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some startups, it's less than half. It might be a third of the cost to get going. I mean, hiring talent is a third of the cost. Rent is a third of the cost. Technology costs are probably about the same. But depending on what your business is, you know, those costs matter. So while you might take a slightly lower valuation, you might be able to steer much more easily.
Yeah. No, that's true. And you're also, you could be the big fish in your pond. I mean, you could be.
Absolutely.
Kind of the big winner.
And the really great companies there, I mean, they're just kind of rock stars. You know, in the Valley, there's all these brilliant people. And for some companies, that's a reason to go there. Mm-hmm. If you need a big base of talent, it's easy to find it there. But it's hard. It's really hard to be the darling. And in the middle of the country, it's a lot easier to be the darling. And you can attract investors that way. And by the way, it doesn't have to be either or. There are more and more Silicon Valley investors are realizing that there's diamonds in the rough in the middle of the country. And you look at you know, funds like Drive Capital in Columbus, which are some former Sequoia guys who realized that there's all these great deals that are getting missed in the middle of the country. And they started a $250 million fund. And I think they just raised an additional fund to go after those. So, you know, sometimes you can do the best of both worlds.
Yeah, sure. So what are some things that you're excited about that you're seeing in the venture market today?
Well, there's always new and exciting things. I think on the biotech side, you're seeing, lots of great, circulating cell diagnosis technologies that are really exciting, that'll diagnose people earlier for diseases. You know, I think you're seeing the beginning of the proliferation of genetics testing and protocols where companies are trying to customize your cancer treatment, for example, based on sequencing your cancer genome. And I think that stuff is really exciting, not just from a business perspective, but for mankind.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously the connected internet of things, so to speak. I mean, there's always new cool stuff coming out. There's one that I saw recently that I liked, is called Mello, and it's a sous vide cooker. So you can put your, you know, food in this packet and you drop it in the water and you leave for the day. And whenever, you set it for the timer or you're on your way home, you let it know, and you have this, sort of gourmet hot meal cooked for you when you come home.
Wow.
I mean, there's just a lot of cool stuff coming out.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah. Cause sometimes it feels like everything's been done, and then yet we're like barely cracking the surface other times. It's kind of incredible.
No, I mean, we're accelerating at a faster rate. I don't completely drink the Ray Kurzweil Kool-Aid, but probably 80% of it. And you know, we're growing at a faster rate. It's funny. I had dinner with my mother the other evening, and we were said something about her. You know, it's funny because she's 72 and she's got this big iPhone 6 Plus that she can barely hold in her hand. She was asking how to do something, and she said, "You know, I didn't grow up with these." And I said, "Mom, I didn't either." You know, and I'm fairly young, but I didn't either. And this is all new stuff. If you think about how long smartphones have been around, they're still relatively new.
Yeah.
And now you're adding wearables and all sorts of other things to it. So it's really an exciting time, to be an innovator or even to be a consumer. So,
absolutely, yeah. So where do we keep up with you and Venture First online?
Sure. So you can check out Venture First at venturefirst.com. And you can follow me on Twitter. It's John_Shumate_.
Perfect. Yeah, no, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on here today.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to John Shumate for coming on, especially with such short notice. I think it was like the next day he jumped on after we reached out. If you want to keep up with Venture First or find out more about what they're doing, go to venturefirst.com. Thanks to our sponsors, Optimizer WP, that's optimizerwp.com, and ChargeBee. You can check them out at chargebee.com/rocketship. We're going to continue on Wednesday with the final episode in this funding series. We'll have one more interview on Sunday, but the last episode will be Wednesday, and that'll all be on the current state of venture capital today. Please subscribe on whatever podcast player you're listening to, and make sure to leave us a review. It helps out so much. And if you haven't yet, follow us on Twitter at RocketShipFM. You can follow me at Michael Saka and Joel at Joel Goldman. We'll see you in just a couple days.
Please subscribe. Bye-bye.